Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, or discipline me in your wrath. Have mercy on me, Lord, for I am faint. Heal me, Lord, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord? How long? Turn, Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. Among the dead, no one proclaims your name. Who praises you from the grave? I am worn out from my groaning. All night long, I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy, and the Lord accepts my prayer. All my enemies will be overwhelmed with shame and anguish. They will turn back and suddenly be put to shame. The words of David from Psalm 6. Although they could just as easily be the words of Job, couldn't they? And maybe this morning you're sitting here thinking, yeah, those could be my words too. The Psalms have a way of resonating with us deeply. We don't spend enough time in the Psalms. And again, if you're asking, why is he reading from Psalms when we're talking about Job? Job is very related to the Psalms and Proverbs. In the Hebrew order of the Old Testament, it's right smack dab between those books. In your Bible, it's in front of Psalms. But it's interesting that Job will quote bits of Psalms and will give us bits of Proverbs as well, like what we've already read and what we're about to read. That's how Job feels. He's crying out to God, asking, why, God? Why is this taking so long? Why is this happening? Today we're going to meet some of Job's friends, and they're pretty useless theologians, but they're going to speak in ways that maybe sometimes we speak. They're going to express some thoughts that maybe sometimes we have. Last week we took our first look at Job and we realized that three times in the first two chapters, and two of them are spoken by God himself, we learned that Job is, okay, one person got it, let's try it again. To remember last week, Job is blameless. And I told you that the reason that I want to emphasize that is because we're likely to back away from that point. And confession time, I kid you not, sitting in that pew this morning at 6:30 in the morning, I had this wonderful thought, and I thought, I'm going to say that in my sermon until I realized that if I say that, I'm assuming Job is not blameless. It's our instinct, isn't it? That we want to figure out why this is happening. And so this really great point I made, I made more influenced by Job's friends than Job and what God say in this book. Job is blameless. Nothing that happens in this story is Job's fault. And maybe you can sympathize with Job. You've been doing all the right things. You've been keeping God prioritized in your life. You've been worshiping him. You've been setting forth him first above everything, and bad stuff happens. And you're asking, why, God? Why? Last week it was, why do we worship God? Why would we stay faithful to God? The accusation made against Job is, well, you know, it's just because of the good stuff he has. If all the good stuff goes away, well, he'll curse God. Yet, Job was blameless through that. He lost everything he had that made him great. He lost everything he had to be able to earn more wealth. He lost it all. And he didn't sin. He was blameless. Then his health goes. Yeah, you took away all his stuff, but now he's going to suffer because, you know, his health will go away. Then he'll curse God. Nope. He still holds on to his faith. I told you the instinct is going to be to cast blame. Because surely bad things only happen to bad people, right? That whatever bad is happening in life, surely it's judgment from God because of something that's happened. That's what Job's wife thinks. Mrs. Job. That's what she thinks. Chapter 2, verse 9, she talks to Job and she says, "Seriously? Are you still maintaining your integrity?" In other words, we've lost our kids, we've lost all that we have. Now you've lost your health and you're still claiming you haven't done anything to deserve this? Seriously? Curse God and die. She's probably not going to win the Wife of the Year award, is she? But we do this, don't we? We tend to have her mindset on a lot of things, don't we? We talked about it a little bit last week. Why is this happening? You flip on your TV, which I don't recommend at the moment, and you'll find everybody blaming somebody else for what's happening. The right blames the left, the left blames the right, the middle blames both sides, and everybody blames them because they're part of the problem and not the solution, right? And you blame the president, and you blame the guy that's running for president, and you blame the South, and you blame the North, and you blame the East, and you blame the West, and you blame, and you blame, and you blame, and we do this, don't we? This is how we act. All this is somebody's fault because somebody did something, and this is... Nope. And we start talking about people. And start talking about God instead of talking to God on behalf of the people. At the end of Job, that's what God criticizes Job's friends for. Because they try to speak on behalf of God. They try to defend God. They're like, God wouldn't do this to somebody that's innocent, Job. Don't you speak like that. Don't you say these things. And at the end, God goes, why are you standing up for me? Of course I did all this. And if Job prays on your behalf, I'll forgive you. The difference in this story is that Job's friends talk about God. And they blame people. Job talks to God. And he asks why. And God rewards that. Now, we're going to be looking at the speeches in Job. Everything we've looked at up until this point is prose. It's just like the narrator speaking. But all of a sudden we get into this poetry stuff that's very much like Psalms. And it's all informed by this next phrase from Job. Look at verse 10 of chapter 2. He replied, "You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" And in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. He's going to realize that this is happening for a reason that he doesn't understand. But it's not his fault. And everybody's going to keep laying it as his fault. So there's three cycles of conversations that make up most of Job. Job's got three friends there that speak, and there's a fourth guy that kind of shows up at the end. We're not going to mess with him right now. But the three friends all want to help Job see what the problem is and point out this is why all this is happening, and therefore, and Job keeps coming back going, this is happening for sure, but it's not because of why you say it's happening. Because Job is blameless. And so the friends start chiming in, each one. Job pours out his heart and says, "This is how I'm feeling right now." And then Eliphaz speaks up, and Job has to go, "No, you're not right." And the next friend speaks up, and Job goes, no, you're not right." And then the third one speaks up, "No, you're still not right." Then all three friends double down and go even deeper into their accusations on Job. And at the beginning of this thing, Job is just, "You're a really good guy." And at the end of this, they're going, "Job, you're sinful! You're awful, Job!" And the whole time, Job keeps coming back going, this is happening. It's not happening for why you're saying. And he keeps wrestling with the question, God, why? Here's how Job feels. He's pouring out his heart at the end of chapter 3, and he says, "For sighing has become my daily food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil." That's what Job is facing. And the next verse is where everything starts going wrong. Because the next verse we read that, "Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied." Now up until this point, Job has the best friends in the world. I don't have friends as good as Job does. Because when Job's in the middle of his misery, his friends show up and they sit with him in silence for a week. And it's all downhill from there. We do this sort of thing. We want to speak into the situation and we want to give our wisdom. And I did it this week. I had somebody pouring out their heart and I tried to speak and I realized I shouldn't be saying this. Eliphaz speaks up. And he tells us that Job's a pretty good guy. Starting in verse 2. "If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient?" In other words, can it be my turn to talk? "But who can keep from speaking? Think how you have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. But now trouble comes to you, and you are discouraged. It strikes you, and you are dismayed. Should not your piety be your confidence and your blameless ways your hope?" Paraphrase here. Job, you're a good guy. You live out the Torah. You're looking out for those who are disadvantaged. You're trying to raise up the people. You're looking for lifting up the downtrodden. You're a good guy. And shouldn't all that goodness in your life give you hope, Job? Watch these next words, though. "Consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed?" Let's pause for just a minute. Who in this story has perished? Who has been destroyed? It's not Job. Job's sitting there talking to us. Job's children have been destroyed. Who is Eliphaz blaming? Yeah. Really good friends now, aren't they? Job, this is your kid's fault. Because, you know, good people don't suffer, right? Look at the next verse. "As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. And at the breath of God, they perish. At the blast of his anger, they are..." Remember, your kid ticked off God and he killed him. What a friend. But have you ever heard such a thing? Have you ever heard well-intending Christians say equally as stupid and offensive stuff? I've done it. It's really hard to make sure some of my old sermons never see the light of day again. Because we tend to do this sort of thing, don't we? Eliphaz is looking for a reason to blame. He goes, this is Eliphaz's theology, basically. Bad stuff doesn't happen to good people, Job. Your kids died because they were bad kids, and you're suffering because you've done something. But Job is blameless. It's not that cut and dry, is it? Eliphaz is speaking to Job, and he's speaking about God, but Job flips it around. Job starts talking to God, and he's commended for it in the end. And we're going to hear some psalm-like language here. This is chapter 7, and starting in verse 11. Job is responding to Eliphaz's attacks, and again, this cycle carries on throughout the book. Job says to God, "Therefore I will not keep silent. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea monster of the deep that you put me under guard, God? When I think my bed will comfort me and my couch will ease my complaint." Sound a little bit like Psalm 6 from earlier? Yeah. "Even then you frighten me with my dreams, terrify me with visions, so that I prefer strangling and death rather than this body of mine. I despise my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone because my days have no meaning. What is mankind that you make so much of them, that you give them so much attention?" Psalm 8, Hebrews chapter 2. "That you examine them every morning and test them every moment. Will you never look away from me or let me alone even for an instant? If I have sinned, what have I done to you? You who see everything we do. Why have I been made your target? Have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my offenses and forgive my sins? For I will soon lie down in the dust. You will search for me, but I will be no more." Job is convinced he's dying, and he's done for, and he's pleading with God, and he's saying, "God, why? Why, God? Even if I've sinned, let me know what it is. Tell me why this is happening. I don't understand it, God. And if it's my fault, why can't you forgive me, God?" Job is basically hollering at God and saying, "God, act the way that I know you're supposed to act. Be the God that I know you're to be, because I don't understand it." And again, we talked a little bit last week. Christians are really uncomfortable with this kind of language, aren't we? We think we're only supposed to pray things like the Lord's Prayer, right? And we're supposed to pray the Lord's Prayer. I'm going to preach on the Lord's Prayer at the end of this summer. But when you're hurt, you can talk to God and tell him you're hurt. When you've got the question of why, you can ask God, "God, it doesn't make sense. Why?" And you can pour out your heart in front of him, and he's going to listen to it. He's going to hear it. And again, we looked at it last week. If you don't believe me on that, when Jesus, who is also blameless, is saddled with the guilt of this world, he yells out Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me?" It's okay to hurt. It's okay to mourn. It is okay to be angry. But instead of talking about one another, let's talk to God about it. Instead of being like Eliphaz's buddies and casting blame left and right, let's talk to God about it. That's what we see Job doing here. He's pouring out his heart before God, and in that, he speaks rightly. In that, he's blameless. We ought to be doing the same. Fast forward. There's a high point in Job. If you make movies or you write songs or you write stories, you know that there's like this two-thirds rule. Like you want to build up to this climax, and about two-thirds through, there's something really important, some hinge point in the whole story that happens. For me, in Job, it's chapter 28. Because the narrator speaks back up. And after all of the cyclical poems of speaking back and forth, and Job defending, and his friends coming back and accusing, and Job defending, and his friends coming back and blaming everything in the world on Job, Job maintains his integrity. And then the narrator chimes in and he goes, basically, guys, everybody that's reading this, pay attention. This is what you're supposed to get out of this. And in chapter 28, we read, starting in verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? Because there's wisdom being thrown around left and right here, but it's not the right kind of wisdom. Where does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds in the sky. I mean, they've got a better view than we do, right? They can't see it. They can't figure it out. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. Even after this life, they can't figure it out. Verse 23 is the key to this whole story. God understands the way to it. And he alone knows where wisdom dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and the path of the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. And he confirmed it and tested it. And then we get a little echo from Proverbs chapter 1. And he said to the human race, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding. The psalmist in Psalm 6 shuns the evil. We read about Job and we read that he shuns evil. Job's blameless. And Job in the story points us to God. He's the source of the wisdom. It's not what you guys are saying it is. I don't know what it is, but I know he's got the answer. Job is blameless. Not a thing he did to deserve what happens to him. But that happens when you follow God. I'm not going to preach to you the wealth and prosperity gospel that you give your life to Jesus and $100 bills are going to show up in your mailbox. You can find that message out there, but I'm not going to give it to you. That's not what the Bible says. I'm reminded of Jesus' words after he broke bread with his disciples. In John's gospel, we don't get the supper so much as we get the dinner conversation. And Jesus reminds his friends, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, for I have overcome the world. Job keeps his faith because he knows the God who made it all. Job can't see the whole picture and he can't understand why he's suffering, but he knows the God who does. And Jesus, to his disciples who are about to see untold suffering and grief, I've overcome the world. And though the world may be upside down and on fire at the moment, you know where to put your hope. This morning, if you have no hope, if you haven't put your trust in Jesus Christ, if you have not made him the Lord of your life, if you have not shut out the earthly wisdom and started listening to God for wisdom, you need to do that today. Don't leave here this morning unless Jesus is Lord of your life. If you want to come this morning and you want to pour out your heart before him, we'll listen, we'll pray for you. If you want to put Christ on in baptism and start a new life, we're here to do that with you this morning. But it's not an easy road. But you can take heart because we worship the one who's overcome it all. If you need to respond this morning, come as we stand, as we sing.